He's gone this afternoon too.
Yeah, he's gone.
That's right. That's right. Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the afternoon session of the Portland City Council for March 11th. Would you please call the roll?
Fritz?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman? Novick? Hales?
Here. And Commissioner Novick is away. We expect Commissioner Saltzman to join us shortly. So welcome, everyone. We have one item on the calendar this afternoon. Would you please read that, Carla?
Item 266, transmit report on a potential citywide policy for removing barriers to employment for individuals with criminal histories.
Thank you. Well, I'm very pleased to kick off this discussion this afternoon and to welcome folks here who want to talk about this subject and about this important idea. I think this is one of these times when we as a community come together and do the right thing, and we do it in consultation with everyone involved. There are advocates here that we'll hear from today. There are business people who have figured out how to bring new people into their workforce who've come out of the criminal justice system. I think we're going to learn a lot this afternoon, and we're going to move forward on something where this community once again does the right thing. The City of Portland has already adopted policy for which we call banning the box. We'll hear a little bit more about why we can't quite use that phrase to describe what we do here in Oregon. But we've already banned the box for city employment, and Multnomah County has done the same. Our human resources director reports that that's a great success, and we want that success to spread. It's our intention to have first our city attorney who's worked on this idea come up and make a presentation, then to be followed by some invited testimony from a number of people who are here today, and then have public testimony after that. We want everyone, obviously, to try to be as succinct as possible because we have a lot of people lined up. So I won't make any longer speech than that to kick this off, other than, again, to say thank you for caring and for being here today about an area where we can do the right thing for our friends and neighbors, and invite Judy Prosper from the City Attorney's Office up to make a presentation to get us started. Welcome, Judy.
You gave me a promotion. The city attorney is actually Tracy Reeve. I'm a deputy.
No, I know you're a deputy. We use that term of art. We didn't promote you yet, but Tracy's doing a great job.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
So again, I'm Deputy City Attorney Judy Prosper. It's always my privilege to be before you, especially today, to discuss a very important policy initiative to eliminate barriers to employment for people with criminal histories. So many Americans have had contact with the law, either by being stopped or arrested by police, prosecuted in courts, and convicted of varying degrees of offenses. The purpose of this proposal to amend the Portland City Code that I will outline will be to remove barriers to employment so that people with criminal histories may provide for themselves and their families, to reduce the disparate impacts on people of color that result from the use of criminal history information in hiring and employment decisions, and to assist with the reintroduction of formerly incarcerated persons into community life and to reduce the recidivism rate. Even those who do not spend any time in prison or jail can be adversely affected by employment practices that exclude candidates with criminal histories. The policy proposal I will lay out would create a fair employment process to evaluate these candidates. Full-time employment is the best predictor for reducing the chance that a person with a criminal history will reoffend. Questions about past criminal history can be a deterrent for applicants and can be used too easily by employers to screen out people before their other qualifications for a given position are fully considered. Blanket exclusions also do not take into account any rehabilitation. The City of Portland, as you mentioned, and Multnomah County have already implemented internal policies for delaying inquiries into a person's criminal history until the conditional offer stage. There are exceptions, of course, for law enforcement related positions that involve vulnerable populations and were otherwise required by state, federal, local laws or policies. 108 cities and counties in over 30 states also have policies that delay a review of a person's criminal history. The National Employment Law Project has been at the forefront of advocating for what are colloquially known as ban the box initiatives. And as soon as I figure out how to turn the page, here it is. The box refers to the question often asked on employment applications. Have you ever been arrested or convicted of a crime? Over the last few months, I have reviewed ordinances and laws passed by other municipalities and states. Portland would be at the forefront of this growing trend to require that inquiries into a person's criminal history be delayed until later in the employment process. Nine cities, including San Francisco and Seattle, have been pioneers in instituting this policy in their private sectors. Two other cities, Newark, New Jersey, and Chicago, Illinois, later had their policies superseded by statewide laws. Six states and Washington, D.C. have instituted policies to delay criminal background inquiries. Two counties in Maryland have done the same. Most jurisdictions impose an outright prohibition on having such a question on an employment application, be it in paper form or online. Oregon's expansive free speech clause, Article 1, Section 8, would arguably trump any effort to impose such a limitation on an employer's speech here in Portland. Instead, we have outlined a substantive process for delaying the consideration of a person's criminal history until after a conditional offer of employment has been extended. Portland has often been the leader in Oregon, extending protection to ban discrimination against vulnerable populations before other Oregon cities or the state legislature in Salem. This council enacted code prohibiting discrimination in employment and public accommodations on the basis of a person's sexual orientation, gender identity, source of income, well before our state leaders. We continue to be ahead of the state in prohibiting discrimination based on familial status. We passed and successfully implemented the sick leave ordinance. Portland should be proud of its leadership role in advancing employment rights and continue its track record by considering this proposed policy initiative to remove barriers for people with criminal histories. Let us be clear. Employers would never be prohibited from reviewing a person's criminal history, nor would they be required to hire a person with such a history. The proposed policy would merely delay inquiries so an employer and applicant could together flesh out a person's qualifications and experience first. So the following slides, there are a few of them so we could fit all the states in, will demonstrate some of the statistics that I just spoke of. I'll just flesh out, obviously the first column are states and cities or counties. The second set of columns, private, vendor, or public, indicate in those respective places whether the delaying of consideration happens just on the public level, whether it relates to vendors, or whether it relates to public sector employers. So as we go through, we'll see places like San Francisco, as I mentioned, the state of Hawaii, the state of Illinois, Baltimore, Maryland, the two counties in Maryland, the entire state of Massachusetts. Also, I'll go across all of the columns. One of the important ones that I'll speak more to later is the last column, the EEOC criteria. You'll see that that's a very popular criteria. I'll flesh that out more a little bit later. So as I go through, we find places like Kansas, Michigan, it's state law in Minnesota, state law in New Jersey, North Carolina, Ohio has extended it for the public sector. We here in Oregon, as you mentioned, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Tennessee, places like Texas, Virginia. This slide shows a summary, since we are a municipality, I decided to compare other municipalities. This chart shows the cities that have passed ordinances that extend to the private sector with their populations, the effective date of these ordinances. If you'll see, Philadelphia's effective date was in 2011. They are the longest, they hold the longest ordinance for this type of delaying of the review of criminal histories. Their process is a little bit different than some of the other processes. They only receive complaints, and there is a fine imposed of $2,000 per violation, and that $2,000 goes into the Philadelphia coffers. So, as you can see, these have been implemented as of 2013 and 2014, so there's not a lot of history or case law following those. So the next...
Can I ask a question off that slide?
Absolutely.
I hadn't seen this slide before. It's very, very helpful. So we know that in the civil rights arena, and let's use Oregon as an example, there are some statutes that the federal law applies to employers of 50 or more employees. The Oregon counterpart in some instances is 25 or more employees. There are other statutes that are tailored to the unique jurisdiction. We have a requirement on earned sick leave at the city that has a magic number of 6. So you are proposing that this only apply to employers of 6 or more employees?
Yes, sir. We've ticked it to the sick leave ordinance. We don't want employers to have a whole bunch of different requirements that differ from ordinance to ordinance. So we did use that number just to relate it to another ordinance recently passed.
So let me dive in right there and say that was a real mistake and we shouldn't have done that. It makes it very difficult to do. So I recommend that we look at everybody. It's our experience with sick time was it's so difficult to figure out when 6 and 5 and other disincentives for people to then hire more employees. So I my recommendation and what we've been asking is at the state level in their sick time ordinance is to not have that difference.
Okay.
One of the questions that comes up is the profile of the workplace so that we know who's impacted. And I think the data point that will help guide our deliberation on that is it's just some updated numbers on the profile of our workplace. So how many companies do we have that are, you know, 6 or fewer, how many are the next size, and the like. Do you happen to know, though, in having done your research, why San Francisco settled at 20 or Philadelphia 10? Those are not numbers that are pegged to anything that we're familiar with at the federal level. Were they just compromises worked out by the jurisdictions?
I think you've got the word.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You'll see on the chart that the fourth criteria, when in the process an employer is allowed to review criminal history, varies from the first interview or good faith interview all the way to conditional offer. And that's something I'll talk a little bit about a little later. You'll also notice that all the jurisdictions except for Rochester and Portland have an administrative agency that handles the first line of complaints. That's very important for talking about enforcement later on today. The penalties range from $50 to 90 days in jail as a misdemeanor.
And to clarify, that this box says when the employer is allowed to review, that means not only asking on an employment form, that means they're not allowed to do a background check on everybody?
No, they are not allowed to do a background check on everyone. They are... moving it to the conditional offer stage, which is what we are proposing, is after candidates have been fully evaluated on their merits, their experience, and qualifications, a conditional offer would be extended. And the condition would be you need to pass a criminal background check. And again, I'll flesh out some of the other details later. There could be other criteria, like you have to pass a typing test and prove that you can type the 60 words a minute you said you did on, or some other kind of test. But it's at that stage after the employer is satisfied with the candidate and really wants to hire them. The jurisdictions are split about half and half, and we're talking about 8, as to whether a private right of action exists. But to be noted is that the jurisdictions without a private right of action have robust administrative procedures. And I put the titles of the ordinances so we could, just to make it interesting, actually. So I'm going to go through and highlight the policy being proposed now by the city. The city attorney's office and the mayor's office have reviewed these statutes and ordinances, and we are proposing today, and I'm sure there'll be much discussion on the various pieces of it, a process, and here it is. So when it comes to advertising and applications, employers would be encouraged to remove the box on their employment applications, whether they be in paper form or online. While this proposed policy would not impose a ban on the question of whether a person has a criminal history, in assessing whether an employer violated the policy, the presence of the box could be evidence that criminal history was improperly considered.
And again, the reason that you're suggesting that we take that approach is that the Oregon Constitution's free speech provision probably does not allow an outright ban as a mandate, right?
Exactly. And the ban itself does not necessarily lead to more hiring. You can remove it from your application and then ask them when they drop the application off or early in the interview process. So removing the box from the piece of paper or on an online questionnaire may not actually achieve such a great result. Our proposal is that the employer could only consider the criminal history of a person after making a conditional offer of employment. And as Commissioner Fritz asked and I mentioned earlier, the conditional offer means that you have the job, but you'll have to now, as I do an assessment of your criminal history, that it's going to be contingent on that assessment. And it may be there may be other contingencies as well, as I put here, a drug test or some kind of skills test.
So could you tell me how criminal backgrounds are checked? Are there companies that like rental checks?
Yeah, it's a very good question because I believe it's scattered. It used to be that you could only get someone's criminal background either from the FBI or from a state or local law enforcement agency. But there's a website called ZabaSearch.com. I'm not sure, I'm digressing a little bit, if you know. But what it does is it calls public records from all over and puts them online. And so companies have decided that it's profitable to cull criminal records, which are public records, and create databases so that if you pay them, you can get a criminal record check. The unfortunate thing, and I'm sure other people who are much more versed in this will tell you after my presentation, is that they tend to be fraught with mistakes. Mm-hmm. Arrests are on there. Things that were expunged might be on there. Again, this is not something that I'm expert in, but I do know anecdotally that they tend to be fraught with errors.
Can I ask you a practical question? Someone who has been incarcerated for a period of time may very well have a gap on their resume. So what's the interplay between the resume and the review of a resume by an employer? And secondly, is it typical that an employer checks references before or after a conditional offer is made?
I'm going to be careful not to say I know what typically happens. I'm not an employer, and I know there will be employers here who can speak maybe a little bit better and some advocates who will speak more clearly than I can on the interface. I agree that that is an issue, and those are the kinds of things that will need to be fleshed out in the education piece that we're offering as part of the proposal. Because, and I think advocates for people who are formerly incarcerated will have to work with crafting resumes and talking about different ways to put your best foot forward without highlighting the gaps in your employment.
And I think one of the things we'd be interested in is how other cities have crafted administrative rules to deal with that. So, for example, one of the things that we often highlight in job interviews, let's say someone has had 10 jobs in 5 years and they're in a job every 6 months. I mean, that might prompt a question about, gosh, you've had a lot of different employment things. Why? Right? Well, I kept taking the wrong job or or I forgot to show up for work or whatever, but you'd ask that question. Here, you may very well have on a resume a gap that someone would naturally ask, and how do you deal with that? That's a big question.
Again, I think that that's a question that we could sort of flesh out a little bit later, and where advocates and employers can talk about ways, yep, when we do an education piece and some training on how this is going to go forward. And to answer your second question about when in the process, I think that when there's a box on the application, sometimes that's the point in the process, because that application is never considered if the box is checked.
Right. Thank you.
So I'm not sure I understand about checking references. Does that have to wait until a conditional offer, or can that occur at the first step?
Well, references,
or the second step, or whatever.
References can be checked. An inquiry into whether or not the candidate has a criminal background would not be allowed.
So if I don't do a criminal background, check out the references, and the references are bad, I have no further obligation.
You would have no further obligation. The point of putting it at the conditional offer stage is that all of those things are yes. You've had a meeting of the minds with this candidate. They have the qualifications. You like their personality. You think that they're going to fit in well in the office. It's the last step, or one of the last steps of the process, and not one of the first steps or one of the eliminating factors right off the bat. Does that answer your question?
So references can be an eliminating factor.
References can absolutely be an eliminating factor. If you called my old boss and they said, you know, no, she's not a good candidate, right, there'd be no reason to get to a conditional offer. You would never get to that stage.
Here's an example of how it works in the civil rights context. Sorry. Someone says, I didn't get the job because the employer wouldn't hire me because I was gay, because I was African American, because I was a woman with children, because I was over 40 years old, whatever the category.
Mm-hmm.
The employer then has to have a neutral, non-discriminatory reason for the action taken. Employer says, I had a requirement that you lift 100 pounds on the job. You couldn't do that. I required X or Y, or checked your references and they weren't so good. But the employer's burden is to show that impermissible factor was not driving the decision making.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I understand you're trying to structure here.
Exactly.
A way of making sure that factor does not automatically disqualify someone. It doesn't preclude someone from saying there's other reasons why you're not a good fit for the job, but we're trying to eliminate the front door being closed on someone to even get to the point about whether they're qualified.
Said better than I could have.
No, you said it great. I'm just restating it.
Thank you, sir. So we've reached this individualized assessment criteria. What would happen now after the conditional offer was extended, an employer could now inquire into a person's criminal history. They could simply ask them, do you have a criminal history? Or they could obtain a criminal history report. An employer would then be required to make an individualized assessment to determine whether a specific offense has a direct relationship to the person's ability to perform the duties and responsibilities of the job they are seeking. So conviction matched up with what the duties of the job are. This individualized assessment analysis comes from the EEOC's paper that recommends, it's a 2012 guidance relating to the disparate impact of the use of criminal histories on protected classes that an employer can utilize.
Indeed. And these, I know what EEOC stands for.
Sorry, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission.
Thank you.
So the EEOC recommended some guidelines to use when cases of use of employment history came up and there was a disparate impact on a particular protected class. And the factors in the seminal case Green are the nature and gravity of the offense, the time that has passed since the offense occurred, the conduct or the completion of the sentence, and the nature of the job held or sought. So that links into the individualized assessment that I spoke of a moment ago. So what kinds of things should not be considered by the employer? Again, these are the common factors among the ordinances that have been passed around the country. an arrest not leading to a conviction, except where a crime is unresolved or where charges are pending against someone, if they haven't yet gone to trial for the charge that they were arrested for. Convictions that have been judicially voided or expunged, and charges that have been resolved through the completion of a diversion or deferral of judgment program. I just want to say a little bit about the judicially voided or expunged. A lot of statutes talk about juvenile offenses, and the reason we didn't put that in here is because in Oregon, unlike some other jurisdictions, New York, for example, which I'm familiar with, juvenile offenses are sealed. If you committed a crime and it was adjudicated in family court, no one's ever going to see that record. It shouldn't show up on a criminal background check. In Oregon, you have to take active steps to expunge your record. So if you committed an offense as a minor, after 5 years of a clear record, you apply for expungement. So the reason you don't see juvenile offenses on there is because we'd have no way of removing them from the record unless someone actively expunged it. And that may be a question that others later will talk a little bit more about.
And what's the reason for allowing in when charges are still pending, given that we have an innocent until proven guilty ethic? Why allow discrimination based on something which may or may not turn out to be true?
You know, that's a good question, and I think that that is another one of these compromises, because most employers, I think, and again, I don't want to speak for employers, they'll speak for themselves shortly, want a quick turnaround, and maybe there's sort of this unknown question as to whether the person will be convicted, will they be able to continue the job, are they going to be incarcerated? That kind of iffy question is put in as one of these exceptions to give the employer some confidence that the person that they're hiring is going to be available to do the job long term. Exceptions. So the proposed policy would not apply where a federal, state, or local law regulation requires or authorizes the consideration of a person's criminal history. Such situations will include employment of law enforcement or people working in the criminal justice system, private security employment, where a license is required by the Oregon Department of Safety Standards and Training, employees who would have direct access to or provide services for children, the elderly, persons with disabilities, persons with mental illness, or individuals with alcohol or drug dependence or substance abuse disorders. Employees required to be licensed, registered, certified, or otherwise authorized to practice a profession or trade in this state, and individuals applying for licensure, registration, certification, or authorization to practice such a profession or trade in this state. And lastly, for now, positions designated by the employer as part of a federal, state, or local government program designed to encourage the employment of those with criminal histories.
Is this an example list, or are these the only?
Typical.
These are the typical. They come in all shapes and sizes. I pull these from existing state law that has prohibitions on its funding of such service providers. So, for example, a nursing home that receives state funding would need to be accepted, because they have actually a matrix, a list that was compiled by the Department of Human Services with actual offenses. And so a facility could not avail itself of state funding if they didn't follow those guidelines. Pardon me. So this, each of them are individualized to their state. I put this in sort of Oregonese so that it will be, we could look to something as guidance and not sort of make up categories. So we're proposing a process. If after a conditional offer is extended, an individualized assessment of job relatedness is made, and an employer decides, I'm not going to hire this person, or I'm not going to promote this person, I'm not going to transfer them to a different department, or I'm going to discharge this person after finding out about this criminal history. So if all of that is the case, here's what would have to happen. The person would need to be informed of the adverse employment decision. And the portions of the criminal history would need to be outlined. And outline is the wrong word, which sort of need to be pointed out. And how I describe that as, if you have a written criminal history, you take a highlighter or you circle or you put a check mark next to the convictions that influence the decision, the adverse employment decision. The person would need to get a copy of the criminal history report. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of times they have errors, so it would be good for them to see it and be able to say, yes, this is true or this isn't true. A written notice of rights with a timeline for an opportunity to request reconsideration. I don't want to go back to the other slide because I may not be able to get back here, but there are various deadlines. They go from 2 days to 14 days. We thought 2 days was reasonable. Folks talked about too much time between offer, reconsideration would not be good for either the job seeker or the employer. So we put in 2 days to request reconsideration.
2 days from what?
2 days from receiving an adverse employment decision, a copy of the criminal history, and an indication somehow of what items in the criminal history caused the employer to make the adverse employment decision.
And is that 2 days by certified mail with receipt requested?
Good question.
That is a very good question.
You know, the mail is not necessarily that reliable, or somebody might be out of town for the weekend, in which case you're out of luck.
Normally,
2 days seems a lot, a very short time.
Normally, we'd have to consider actual notice and then figure out the timeline and then different options. I mean, actual notice is handing something to someone, having them acknowledge receipt. That's the best. The next is the presumption of delivery of a letter or certified mail and getting a receipt. That's probably the least efficient for a lot of reasons. So I think Commissioner Fritz raised a very good question, and we should be looking at, to the extent possible, actual notice, because that's the best. There's a receipt that says, I got this notice from you. And that avoids all the sort of complexity of figuring out where they actually got notice and running the clock.
I agree, and this is something that we can flesh out in the rules at the city, the administrative regulations that the city attorney would write up if such an ordinance were to pass. Those are the kinds of nuanced details that we can work out.
But the next one on this list has got my attention because I'm trying to think what other areas of our civil rights laws in particular an employer is required to give a notice of enforcement options. So what's the analogy? Where did you find that, and what's the analogy? What's the analogous requirement that you can think of? And if you can't think of it now, it's perhaps at some point we could come back to it. But you know, employers are required to do reasonable accommodation analysis. They're required to do many things. I'd be interested in knowing currently when does an employer have to give someone a notice that says, and if you disagree with me, here are all your legal rights.
Well, land use notices, for
well,
sure.
Well, no, there's some of that in employment law, though.
I'm talking about the employment law.
Yeah, there people look like they can answer that question, too. So I'm writing these down. That's a good one. So
I'm writing them down, too.
Okay.
So reconsideration. If the person requests reconsideration and whatever we decide is a timely manner based on your comments, the employer would then have 2 business days to reconsider the adverse employment decision. And they would again conduct an individualized assessment of relevant factors that could be offered by the person. And this isn't an exhaustive list, but these are the kinds of things that other jurisdictions have put as rehabilitative or mitigating factors. So the facts and circumstances surrounding the incident, the number of offenses, the age of the person at the time of the conviction or release from prison, that the person performed the same type of work post-conviction with the same or different employer with no known incidents of criminal conduct, the length and consistency of employment history before and after the offense or conduct, the person's participation in rehab efforts, such as education, training, or substance abuse treatment, employment or character references, and any information regarding the person's fitness for a particular position, and whether the person is bonded under federal, state, or local bonding program. And unless the employer reaches a different decision after reconsideration, the adverse employment decision would become final 4 business days after the initial notice. And again, we'll keep in mind that notice requirement and how many days lapse between the request for reconsideration and the final decision. Enforcement.
Can I raise a little red flag here?
Absolutely.
I think we have to think about some safe harbor provision so that these cases don't get litigated on the question of the timeline and instead are on the substance. And I think there has to be some safe harbor around reasonable compliance with these rules. Otherwise, what you're going to have is a game of gotcha about whether the 2 days, the 3 days, the 4 days, the notice, and everything else. So let's and hopefully we'll have someone later lay that out. But I would want to at least consider a safe harbor provision that so we're not just getting hung up on these deadlines. These deadlines are designed to bring this process to a prompt conclusion, to be respectful of the both parties' interests. But I don't think we want to have that be the primary issue in dispute going forward. So we'll come back to that.
Definitely, and I totally agree. And that sort of brings us to this enforcement. And again, that timing, remember, we're talking about only after a conditional offer. So we're not talking about the universe of people who applied for the job. We're not talking about the universe of people who were interviewed, but specific people. And yes, that timing issue does have to be addressed. So on to suggested enforcement. We have two outlined. There could be action by the city attorney, who already has the authority to bring code violations. So if the city attorney determined that a violation of the policy occurred, she could initiate a code violation proceeding after giving the employer notice of and an opportunity to explain the allegations. Again, we don't want it to be a gotcha, we're giving you a summons. We envision some kind of back and forth, like a letter outlining the allegations, some time for a response before a code violation proceeding would be initiated.
So let me ask you on this one, because this one got my attention because it's not typically what the city attorney does in this arena, and yet we do have an agency that typically does these kinds of things, which is the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Was there some consideration to simply contracting administratively with BOLI to handle the administrative component of this rather than essentially creating an enforcement unit within the city attorney's office to duplicate what they do routinely?
Well, historically, the city attorney has not exercised its general law enforcement authority, unlike other cities of our size and offices that prosecute criminal offenses. There is currently no law enforcement capacity within the city attorney's office. This is something that would have to be fleshed out. In terms of BOLI, BOLI is a state entity,
right.
You know, familiar with the state laws. As the city of Portland passes civil rights laws, having the opportunity to litigate those laws here in the city, have an administrative process that could be quick and efficient to adjudicate those, is something that could be beneficial. Again, this is a proposal, and in it we outline sort of a possible way to go about adjudicating these.
Since the mayor's invited us to ask the questions, we're having a forum to ask questions, not to debate, but to sort of put them out there and see if they stick. Let me just express the concern. I have tremendous confidence in the city attorney and in her ability to administer anything we set up. And I'm sure she would come with a specific request. It's a budget request, a staffing request. She would set up the administrative machinery necessary to do this, because I'm guessing, you know, in the first couple of years we could see a lot of action. The question I have is, since there are people already highly trained to investigate and here at the administrative level, these kinds of things at the State Bureau of Labor and Industries, why not consider contracting so that they would enforce this particular statute on behalf of the city and then test drive that relationship? I'm just throwing that out as an idea.
Mm-hmm. My understanding is we already contract with BOLI,
right,
to do the sick leave ordinances, and they are also handling our civil rights ordinances if someone brings a claim under
there. And they will be handling in due course some additional action around fair housing. So there is, and I'm guessing some other city, there's some other jurisdiction that has done something similar. I'm just raising it as an issue.
And you mentioned the term contracting. It costs the city money to ask Boley to adjudicate those cases.
Correct.
They don't just do them. So it, part it, of it.
One of the questions would be: Is it a better or not as good remedy and process? That's a question. And then two is it more cost effective to have them do it or to create a parallel administrative structure at the city attorney's office? I don't know the answer to that.
That's worth fleshing out. Good point.
You didn't talk about private right of action.
Did I not? I'm sorry. Yeah, I just skipped right. Thank you, sir. So the other enforcement mechanism we envision is a private right of action under Oregon Revised Statute 659A.885, which is a civil action, a civil rights action, in a court of competent jurisdiction.
So that one got my attention, too, because I've sued a lot of people in another life under that statute. And so is you're just laying this out as a concept, right? Because it's currently a 7-page statute that has carefully tailored remedies and procedures according to the kind of claim. So you get jury trials with some, not others. You get punitive damages with some, not others. Compensatory damages. You get caps on damages for some claims, not caps on damages for others, and on and on and on. I take it what you're just saying is this would be the statute where we would look to craft the remedy, but right now we'd have to decide what is this most like in terms of state law because there's 7 pages of tailored remedies depending on the claim. Am I right on that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Wait a second. I'm a little confused. So are you saying that statute is what becomes the basis for a private right of action? Are you saying we would create a private right of action that would be modeled
We would create a private right of action as happened with the, and tell me if I'm saying the case wrong, the BSOS case, where sexual orientation was the class of person at issue. And that case has been litigated, and the city of Portland passed a statute extending that protection, and the case was able to be brought under 659A.
In a Multnomah County circuit court.
So describe for me, just in ordinary English, what a private right of action would look like to somebody that receives an adverse determination. What would the attorney writing the demand letter to the employer say in English, not legalese?
You got me on the fly, so here we go.
Yeah.
So they would have received a conditional offer of employment. And the argument would be that the individualized assessment was not reasonable, that their offense was not reasonably related to the job description. So the case I like to use, it's very simple, a former bank robber recently released from prison who applies for a bank teller job. The employer, the bank, could reasonably say, I've done an individualized assessment, and I'm not offering you this job. You would never get to the, the conditional offer would be revoked. So it's what I mentioned earlier, and I'm going to dare, actually. Whoops. See, I knew I shouldn't dare to do anything because.
Carla can help
Turn
you.
It off.
Carla will help you.
Now you've done it.
I know. Thank you, Carla. The little thing.
So,
see, this is what happens when you give me technology.
So just sticking with your example, so if the potential employee responded, well, I robbed that bank when I was 17.
And
now
the
I'm 40. Is that a basis to file a private action?
Well, I think it would be another.
Prevail on private action.
Let me try to create an opposite scenario. So that would be a reasonable decision by that employer not subject to a private right of action because that the previous conviction was reasonably related to the likely risk of that employee being employed there, right?
Not quite, Mayor.
Okay, well, let me stick with me because I'm going to try to paint the opposite
you
picture.
You can't, I know, but just to be clear, whether you think it's reasonable or not, the private right of action is just the door to the courthouse.
Right, Right.
Anybody can file
a claim.
Still
have the right of action.
They can file a claim saying anything they want.
You would not win, but you...
You may not win, but you'd have to establish that you're a protected party, that is, someone covered by the law.
Right.
You'd have to establish that you were given a conditional offer. You have to prove that.
Right.
You have to prove, you have to then allege that it was then discovered or disclosed that you had a prior criminal conviction.
Right.
And that the employer did not exercise a reasonable, was not reasonable in saying that that disqualified me from the job when they withdrew the offer. And that that constitutes a violation of the law, and I'm entitled to damages. And what we haven't figured out, if we do have a private right of action, is what kind of damages, jury trial, attorney fees, what do you get? But that would be the prima facie case.
Right.
So if you were the bank robber and you were only 17, you could sue, but you may not prevail in the courts.
You bring up a really good point, Commissioner Saltzman. And that is the nature-time-nature test, which is part of that individualized assessment. The nature and gravity of the offense, so the robbery, and I'm sorry if the example is a poor one, but the robbery, but it having occurred 25 years before would bring you to the second criteria, which is the time that has elapsed since the offense took place. Now, remember that after the rescinding of the conditional offer, there's that opportunity for mitigating circumstances and evidence of rehabilitation. So that would be a mitigating circumstance. You know, I've lived a law-abiding life at 17, I made this error, and I've lived a law-abiding life, now I'm 45 years old. So those would be the kinds of questions that would decide whether the decision was reasonable.
And currently, if you've received an offer and you request a reasonable accommodation because you have a disability, the employer also has to go through a reasonable process to determine whether you get that accommodation, and that can be tested in court. So the legal question would be a judge deciding whether the time limits have been followed, you qualify as a plaintiff, the law applies to you, and you've alleged that it's not reasonable, and there's some basis for that. And that potentially could then go forward. But that's a lot of burden to get to that point.
Which is why the first option was presented. And as I said, in the option of the city attorney or another administrative process, in a lot of the jurisdictions that have an administrative process be the last step or the as far as you can go on your claim, they have robust administrative agencies that are adjudicating these cases, investigating and adjudicating them. So if, as you said, a place like Boley could be contracted and that could be the final level of adjudication, that's an option.
Well, so it's going to be a better option for most people because most people have trouble finding an employment lawyer to take a case like this. It's a case that is typically taken on a contingent fee basis because most people don't have the attorney fee. So if you don't have an administrative process that's relatively easy, and by the way, the employer sometimes benefits from an administrative process because you get a quicker outcome,
they don't have to pay lawyers,
huh?
And they don't necessarily have
and there's an early mediation. There's a chance to kind of get it right before you're stuck in a 2-year piece of litigation. And
I think you're talking about the access to justice piece, where people who are not typical plaintiffs could still bring a case somewhere and have it investigated and adjudicated without having to seek out a lawyer who's going to make this cost-benefit analysis.
Again, I'm not saying anything out of line here. Most people with claims like this have trouble finding a lawyer who will take the case. Let's just be clear. There's not a lot of people who do these kinds of cases, and they're very careful in their screening. That's why Boley and the EEOC are so important to people seeking to have their claims resolved.
Okay, so let's finish your last slide. I'm sorry we got onto a good discussion.
That's
I'm
okay.
Not sorry, but we got onto a good discussion there.
So a public education and outreach piece. This will not be successful if there is not a strong public education piece developed by the city, implementing outreach to both employers and people with criminal histories to explain exactly what it is such a policy would do, what rights each party would have. So I'm going to end there and just say that if this is something that the city would pursue, and I hope it is, that piece would be essential to the success of such a policy. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you.
But just going back to the beginning of the presentation where you said that we couldn't ban the box, what's to stop a potential employer putting in their ad, foreigners need not apply or felons need not apply? Is that prohibited in other parts of statutes?
In other jurisdictions, it is. Here in Oregon, and I am not an expert on Article 1, Section 8, others here are, but employers, we could not prohibit, we believe, employers from having that question. But in determining whether a violation took place later in the process, the fact of the box or the question
could be used later.
What
I'm concerned about is, will employers now go even further upstream and put something in their announcement about don't even apply if you have a conviction?
Only if they have an enormous amount of money in reserve for legal fees.
Because
what they have done is created a blanket class of plaintiffs. Anybody with a criminal background who applies to that employer is going to say, of course I never got a fair shake because they're advertising. That would be the gold standard for a plaintiff's lawyer to have such a thing. If someone chooses to do that, it would make the cases a lot easier for the plaintiff.
Thank you.
You can't prevent them from doing it, I guess, under the First Amendment, but it would be the plaintiff's bar would be delighted if employers did that.
If someone exercised their right to be that stupid.
In fact, they'd hire someone just to collect those kinds of announcements.
I figured. So thank you for clarifying that. And that would be part of the public outreach that you got to at the end there.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And also the EEOC's guidelines are based on disparate impact. So such a blanket policy by an employer would probably, as Commissioner Fish states, invite a disparate impact claims from all kinds of protected classes.
Judy, thank you. A couple more questions, and then we'll call her back when we complete.
Does this apply to full and part-time employment or simply full-time?
It would apply to all employment. We would probably fashion something that would apply to sort of all people in all positions.
So if you're hiring summer youth and things like that, we'd have to go through this?
Yes, with the exceptions outlined on that exception slide. And if it's a policy, one of those exceptions was a position designated by the employer as part of a program to encourage employment of those with criminal histories. That is one of the exceptions. So if you had a youth employment program with that bend that was trying to rehabilitate youth, then it would fall under an exception.
Great.
So, and maybe this isn't the question for you to answer, but I guess, you know, I can see this maybe working in a large company, but I have a hard time grasping how this is going to work in a sole proprietorship corner market. I mean, I don't think you need to answer that question. I'm having a hard time seeing this working outside of sort of typical corporate America.
Well, I think some of the people we'll hear from today are small businesses that already do this. So I think we could hear how they have made it work.
Well, we also have a chart that says every jurisdiction has taken this up, has debated that very issue.
Right, set a threshold somewhere.
And in San Francisco, which is a pretty liberal place, they've said you have to have 20 employees. So that would be well above the sort of small neighborhood. The typical neighborhood small business in Portland has five or fewer employees. So that's just as a way of comparison.
Judy, thank you. We'll have you back either at the end of this or at our next phase. But thank you for great work. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your attention.
So we have some panels lined up, starting with some folks that actually place people now into employment that are coming out of the criminal justice system. I'll call a panel of one first because of the number of chairs and then some more people. But let me start with Holly Whittleton from Southeast Works. Welcome.
Thank you, Mayor Hales and City Commissioners, for the opportunity to speak this afternoon. I've been asked to speak to Southeast Works and our workforce development efforts with individuals with backgrounds and second-chance employers, as we call them, and the impact of employment on recidivism. We know that employment matters and that we want to endorse ban the box or fair chance. For over 18 years, Southeast Works has delivered workforce development and youth education and career development through our nonprofit community-based development organization. In 2013-14, we served over 3,000 individuals with backgrounds including adults and justice-involved youth ages 16 to 24. And our WorkSource Portland Metro Southeast Center serves the highest percentage of those who self-attested in the system to a background. And we have about 17% of our population who are coming through the WorkSource Center self-attesting. We have really moved to pre-release work versus post-release work. And that pre-release work is including work on securing identification for employment, working with employers pre-release for an individual, and securing health care to ensure that they have a job, that they have housing, and that they have health care in place. We also work around 10 programs for reentry through our integrated WorkSource development model with drug courts and the court diversion programs and a multidisciplinary treatment and justice program for gang-involved youth in Rosewood. And these programs really work to empower individuals with backgrounds by teaching them through really relational case management, tailored workshops, and through one-to-one work with their case manager, how to explain their skills and their abilities, not their background. We need to get to that, but we need to start talking about their skill and ability first. And so we work with individuals to get them training through the WorkSource centers, and that could be anything from forklift certification through to HVAC training. And then working with those employers who have deemed themselves second-chance employers to get those positions so that they're not constantly stuck in transitional or survival jobs. They're looking at some career track employment, which is really important. One of the integrated programs that's really been one of our most successful has been the Prisoner Reentry Employment Program, actually funded by the City of Portland and through WSI, Work Systems, Inc., and through a three-year career track model, which is highly relational with the case manager, the individual is placed in a job and case managed and worked with the employer on a constant basis to see if there's any issues that are happening with that particular customer who's been placed. In 13-14, we placed 102 participants in that program, and of 102 participants, 76% became employed with an average hourly wage of $13.71. And we have a recidivism rate of 1%. If you look nationwide, recidivism rates are over 67% in some of the states. So we believe that it's highly relational model, the follow-up, the work with the employer, and the front end, which we do a lot of job carving on behalf of the customer to get the proper placement. We're not going to take somebody with a background, you know, as Judy has just explained, maybe that had robbery putting them in a position that the employer's, you know, not interested in hiring them in. So we really try to tailor make the jobs to the individuals. We've also been very successful with a very large Department of Labor grant over a five-year window that we've tracked. We had 809 participants, 631 or 77% of those individuals were placed in employment, and only 69 out of that 631 recidivated, 11%. So we're seeing that employment is the answer, along with housing and health care, but employment really does drive recidivism rates. We've worked for many, many years, for anyone that knows Southeast Works, in cultivating second-chance employers. We have a huge database of those individuals. And what we know is that it takes a lot of time, and it takes education and context for the business to embrace hiring those with backgrounds. It really does. And there's a lot of mythology with backgrounds, and employers are not well-educated in relation to that. Not all employers are keen to hire, and the box is used as a deterrent, really, you know, to hire individuals that we do put forward. But we do have businesses that do give individuals a second chance. And I think we're really honest with our employers, and we sell skill and ability, not character. And that's what we're clear about. And that really building that relationship with the employer is absolutely critical from our end so that there is a trust between the employer and Southeast Works that we're going to give them the best candidate possible for the job. I did get the chance to talk to a few employers before I came here today, and some of them are second chance and some of them quite large employers who do hire individuals, and they felt that you needed to get some of the best champions on this initiative, which were Chambers of Commerce,